Okay, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in 1 Samuel. We left off in chapter 30, and Lord willing, we'll finish up this book tonight. But actually, chapter 30, I guess chronologically, it almost should go before chapter 29, but that's neither here nor there, but simply because I think that you look at the situation where we talked about Saul in chapter 28, and how he went to see the witch of Endor, and then the day after that he was going to die. Well, just in passing, because I don't think I really covered as much as I would like to have as far as that chapter 28, when Saul, he was in a situation where he was really hard pressed with the Philistines, because they were going to be a major battle, and all the Philistines were gathering their forces by the tens and by the thousands, and Saul just knew he was really had his back up against the wall. But he's in a situation now where he seeks God, and he's asking God for advice, and he's asking what he should do, but God doesn't answer him. And I really do believe that you get in a situation where you constantly rebel against God and are constantly defiant to his will and constantly making the poor choices and wrong decisions. And there comes a time when, like it says in Proverbs, and I read last week, where a disaster is just going to come upon you. And you're just going to reap what you sow. And Saul went out there and killed all the priests of Nob, killed about 80 men that were God's servants, and now he's got nobody to turn to. So what does he do? He turns to this witch of Endor to try to raise up Samuel from the dead to find out what's going to happen, what he should do, and that type of thing. Well, when we went through 28, we found out that he gets into this seance to conjure up Samuel. And I believe, I firmly believe, that this is the only place ever in history that a person who died actually came back to communicate with the living. And I believe strongly that people who get involved in seances and trying to communicate with the dead, do they get involved with necromancing, this type of thing, they're not dealing with the deceased loved ones. They are dealing with demonic spirits that are impersonating the deceased loved ones. Because if you listen to the message that constantly comes through these mediums that act as a go-between between the living and the dead, and listen to their message, it's always the same. You can always detect where they're coming from, because the Bible says, hey, test every spirit, because every spirit is not of God. And sometimes these people, these mediums, will go into a trance and they will so-called regress to past lives, prior lives, and they'll speak in a different language altogether under this medium hypnosis or whatever. And people say, well, this is proof positive that these people, you know, have died in the past, and that because they can tell you details and they can give you information of things that other people wouldn't have known. But you know what? I mean, you look at what's going on, they will say things like, well, there's no hell, there's no judgment, and Jesus Christ, he's not really God. He didn't really die on a cross to save men from men's sins. He's just a great avatar. He's just a great ascended master. I mean, this is the same thing that constantly is being fed people in these seances. And that's exactly what Saul did. He went and he tried to conjure up Samuel. But I believe God intervened in that particular situation, and Samuel did come up, and Samuel rebuked him for doing just that, as far as disobeying God, as far as communicating with the dead. And then Samuel pronounced his coming judgment the next day. I kind of went through that just so we get an idea of where this story is picking up from, because after we read that, we read about how David now, because he didn't seek the Lord's advice and counsel, or at least it didn't seem like he did, he ends up trying to run away from Saul, and he goes to King Achish of the Philistines, and this King Achish gives him a city called Ziklag where David could live in. And so David has made himself look like he's just a loyal servant of Achish. But now David finds himself in a situation where he has to fight alongside the Philistines with his people. Now, I know that David is really hard-pressed and wondering what to do here, because that's something he didn't want to do. But if he was to tell Achish, no, I'm not going to fight against my own people, then that would have been considered treason, and he probably would have lost his life. So anyway, what does he do? He starts out with the armies of the Philistines to go up towards Gilboa to fight against Saul. But then the other lords of the Philistines, when they get one look at David, they say, hey man, isn't this David? Isn't this the guy who they sing about that has slain his 10,000s and Saul his 1,000s? And they said, get this guy out of here, because in the midst of battle he may turn on us, and just for the very purpose of trying to ingratiate himself with Saul. So that's where this story basically picks up. is that David is now told, turn around and go back. So God, in a sense, and God in his mercy, has really been gracious to David, even though I think that David made a pretty big mistake by not seeking God's advice when he went to the territory of the enemies to escape Saul. And so this is where this story picks up in this chapter 30. But look at that verse 11 of chapter 29, because David is told to turn around and go back. So it says in that verse 11 in chapter 29, it says, so David arose early, and he and his men, to depart in the morning, to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. And then it happened that when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on the Ziklag, and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. And they took captive the women and all who were with them, both the small and the great, and without killing anyone, and carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, behold, it was burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. And David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until there was no strength in them to weep. Now David's two wives had been taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. Moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now this is what's unfolding here. You see, like I said, I don't want to be too uncharitable here, or I don't want to be too speculative, but I really get the impression that David did not seek God's will when David tried to escape from Saul. And he went to Ziklag. He went in the Philistine territory to try to get away from Saul. Because now he's got a situation where, because I think he didn't ask for God's wisdom and guidance and direction, now this whole thing comes full circle. And like I said, I mean, if there's one scripture verse that I live by, is Proverbs 3:5, where it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. And I feel like we need to pray about everything, constantly. Just be praying, asking God's wisdom, asking God's direction. Because, you know, let's face it, if we just use our own reasoning, you know, we're told in James that there's a wisdom that comes from above, and there's a wisdom from below, man. And there's a vast difference between them. And we have to look at things from God's perspective. And I think David failed to do that. So what happens? He ends up marching with the Philistines all the way up here. Here's Ziklag down here. I don't know if you can see it on this map here. But he marches all the way up here. In other words, this is almost a 75-mile trek. He almost gets up there. And then the lords of the Philistines see him. They say, hey, man, we don't want this guy. He's bad news. So he turns around and goes back. So he's gone for at least 3 days from the city of Ziklag. And that's when I think the Amalekites, I mean, they just figure, hey, man, everybody's up north fighting this big battle. So they just make this big, huge raid down in the Negev here to just take spoil, take captive anybody they could. So here's what happened. David gets back from this battle, and he finds the whole city burned. He finds everything missing, and his men are really, really distraught. He's distraught. They're weeping until there's no more strength left in them, and then they're ready to stone David. But what does it say that David does? Because I think it's pretty significant. I think in verse 6 it says, moreover, David was greatly distressed because the people spoke of stoning him, for all the people were embittered, and each one because of his sons and his daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now, that little sentence there, in the latter part of that verse 6, I think it says volumes. I really do. David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. I mean, that's something that when everything's coming down around us, as far as our circumstances and as far as our situations in life, I mean, that's what we've got to do. We have to turn to God for strength, for wisdom, for guidance, for direction, to be able to hang in there, to hang on. But what are people turning today to in their distress? They're turning to everything from drugs to alcohol, any form of escape. I don't care if it's just simply sitting in front of the TV for 60 hours a week or whatever. We are living in a world that's stuck. Pressure cooker world. There's all kinds of problems that we have to deal with, and you just get slapped upside the head with all kinds of difficulties. I know I just come home tonight and I find another $800 bill sitting in front of me for a medical bill because of Gail's illness. I think, oh man, here we go again. And you're like, you can hardly get your breath. But it's like, what are you going to do? I mean, you just got to look to the Lord, trust the Lord, and just commit it to Him. And that's what David is doing here, and in, you know, strengthening himself in the Lord. I mean, he touches God in prayer. You know, he finds release, and he finds hope. He finds encouragement. He finds a sense of a purpose in spite of his situation. So then at the beginning of that verse 7, it says, "Then David said to Abiathar, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, please bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them? And he said to them, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them. You shall surely rescue all." Now, here's the thing. David's really hard-pressed. He strengthens himself in the Lord, and now he's seeking for God's direction. So he asks Abiathar, the priest, to bring the ephod. Remember, the ephod is a priestly vestment, but in this priestly vestment, they have the two stones called the Urim and the Thummim, and that's the way to determine what God's will would be, that the priest would intervene and ask God questions, and then they would use these stones, and I'm assuming they would cast them like lots or like dice, and then they had inscriptions written on them, and they would be able to discern what God wanted them to do. Like I said, that's been way lost in antiquity. We have no idea what they look like, but today we don't need those things because we've got God's Word and we've got His Holy Spirit. That's the Urim and the Thummim that we use today to seek God's wisdom and counsel. But you see, David, to me, David should have done this before he took off into enemy territory and seeking God's will. And he probably could have avoided this whole big mess. But beginning of that verse 9, it says, "So David went, and he and the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Bezor, where those left behind remained. And David pursued, and he and 400 men, or 200 who were too exhausted to cross the brook of Bezor, remained behind." So just keep this in mind. You can't see it on a map here, but these guys have been traveling for 3 days. All right, and then they get down here zigzag, and then they find out this bad news. And then, so they take out after the Amalekites. The 600 men take off, but the two of them are too exhausted to keep up. And they haven't really gone that far as the Brook of Bezor is concerned. But the problem is they've been at it for around 3 days now as far as traveling. So anyway, long story short, what happens to these guys? It says here they were too exhausted to cross the brook. So what happened? 200 of them are left behind, and they're left behind with the baggage. But then it says here in that verse 11, it says, "Now they found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David and gave him the bread, and he ate, and he provided him water to drink. And they gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins, and he ate. Then his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. And David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. We made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites, and on that which belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And then David said to him, will you bring me down to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band. Here's the situation too. You can see God's providence in this, but I think it has a real, significant spiritual message. While they are pursuing the Amalekites, they come across an Egyptian that has been abandoned by the Amalekites because he fell sick. So they just left him out there to die, sickness or die of exposure or whatever. They didn't give a hoot about him. They just left him there to die. So David comes upon him and his men, and what do? They give him something to eat. They give him some substance. They give him some water. He hadn't eaten or drank for anything for 3 days. And then he revives, and then they question him, well, who are you? And he tells them, I was part of this band. He says, I was a slave from Egypt, and I was part of this group, this band of men, these Amalekites, who went down there and made this raid on Ziklag. And so David says, okay, well, look, can you tell us where to find them? And he says, only if you swear to me by God that you're not going to take my life. Now, here's this kind of significant as far as the spiritual, application is. He's an Egyptian, which, spiritually speaking, what does that symbolize? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Egypt is the world. And if he's an Egyptian, it means here's a person in the world. In other words, just apply it spiritually. Here's an unsaved person. But how does David deal with this man? He first meets his physical needs in order to put him in a position where the man can be of use to him. In other words, I don't want to stretch this too far, but if we're going to go out to witness for Christ, for example, especially if you're in a missionary field and you've got people that are in refugee camps or wherever that are starving or have tremendous physical needs, you're not going to get too far with the gospel with them if all you're going to do is preach Christ and not meet their physical needs first. You see what I'm saying? I think that that's foregone conclusion. And that's why I think Jesus himself said, hey, I was hungry, and I was thirsty, and I was sick, and I was naked, and I was in prison, and I was a stranger, and what did you do for me? And he says, whatever you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me. And I think sometimes if we're going to be an effective witness to people or lead people to Christ, we have to meet their physical needs first. We have to be aware of that, because that's what James tells us, right? He rebukes people saying, what good is your faith if you say to your brother, be well and eat hearty, and your brother is in need, and you don't give him anything to meet his need? He says, hey, man, you're basically sinning. So, like I said, I didn't want to beat that to death, but I think there's a spiritual message there, that David meets this man's need, and then he becomes part of David's army, because now he's been cared for by David, and he becomes very useful to David. But look, interesting thing, too. This Amalekite is left on the side of the road to die. In the Amalekites, you know, you can almost see it in the spiritual sense, okay, the spiritual warfare that we're in. You can see how often the devil will just simply use people and just discard them like a used Kleenex when he's done with them. And you can see this with this band of hooligans. When they're done with this Egyptian, they got no more use for him, and it can be no use to them. They just toss him away. They have no concern about him or his welfare or his well-being or something like that. Well, that's the way it is with the powers of darkness. That's the way the devil is. I mean, he will just use a person to no end, and then when he's done with him, he'll discard him. He has no concern about them or their welfare whatsoever. I don't care if they're in Satan worship. Satan hates them with a passion, too. I mean, when he's done using them for his own purposes, he's going to discard them, too. You know, so you can see the vast difference between an Amalekite and David, or you can see a vast difference between Jesus and the devil. And you can see it in here. And then he says here in that verse 13, and David said to him, to whom do you belong, and where do you, are you from? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt and a servant of Amalekites, and my master left me behind when I fell sick 3 days ago. It says in verse 14, and we made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites and on that which belongs to Judah and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. And David said to him, will you bring me down to this band? And he said, swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will bring you down to this band. And when he had brought them down, behold, they were spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David slaughtered them from twilight until evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 men who rode on camels and fled. Now, look at this situation. They come upon the Amalekites. The Amalekites are doing what? They're really whooping it up. I mean, they're eating and they're dancing and they're drinking and they're just having a grand old time, all right? And David comes up with them and he attacks them by surprise. But it says, and now I'm not sure exactly how this reads, but in that verse 17 it says, and David slaughtered them from twilight until the evening of the next day. I get the impression that David's men are fighting these Amalekites for a whole day, a 24-hour period, and he slaughters them all except 400 of them managed to escape on camels. Now, how many men did David have? He started out with 600, but for the battle, he had 400. Now, well, 400 men escaped, so you know that, man, this was really a tough, tough battle, all right, that he had in his hands, but he completely trusted God in this. Now, here's the thing that I think is very significant. You go all the way back to the 17th chapter of the book of Exodus, and we read about Amalek. Amalek, all right, is the father of the Amalekites. And Amalek was the very first one to attack God's people. But the spiritual significance about that is that Amalek represents what?
It's our flesh.
It represents our fallen nature. It represents our flesh. I mean, it really does when you begin to see the spiritual applications. Because I'm just going to read you a little bit from Exodus chapter 17. Because it says this, beginning with verse 8. Now, this is when the people were wandering in the desert. And it says, with Moses, and it says, and Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses says to Joshua, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Ur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hands down that Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Ur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus the hands were steadied until sunset. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write in a book as a memorial, and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under the sun. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, and the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Now, keep this in mind. This is what Amalek represents, is our fallen nature. And when we accept Christ, this is the first thing that's going to attack us, is our own nature. And Amalek attacked who? He attacked the stragglers and the weaklings and the sick. He attacked those who were straggling behind. This is where Amalek will always hit us hardest, is where we are weakest. This is where the devil will always use our nature to turn us against us. Isn't that what happened even to Jesus when he was in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights and hadn't eaten anything? I mean, the devil comes up to him, and how does he attack him? He attacks him with Amalek, meaning this. The devil knows that Jesus is famished. So that's how he attacks him. He says, hey, if you're really the Son of God, turn these stones into loaves of bread. Jesus turned around and recited scripture to him from Deuteronomy. He says, it is written that man shall not live on bread alone, but every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. This is how we're always attacked. Each one of us has his fallen nature, and we all have different weaknesses, and we all have different strengths. And the devil knows what our weakness is, and he knows how to attack us. That's in our walk with Christ. That's always the most difficult thing, is our fallen nature. And he says to us very plainly that, hey, this is a battle that's going to go on from generation to generation. That's what I just read in Exodus 17. And here, the battle lasted all day, all night. This is the impression I get. And this is the only way we're going to defeat Amalek. Because remember, how did they defeat Amalek? We said that whenever Moses had his hands up and praying and interceding on behalf of Joshua down there fighting Amalek, it says that Joshua began to prevail. But every time Moses became too exhausted and he put down his hands, it says that Amalek began to prevail. So in order to counteract this, what did they do? It was Aaron and Ur. They rolled on a big stone under Moses, and Moses sat on it, and they both upheld his arms until Joshua got the victory. And you know what? That's the only way we're going to get victory over our fallen nature, is through constant, continuous prayer. That's the only way we're going to get it. That's it. Otherwise, Amalek can ruin us as far as our Christian walk is concerned. I'll just open it up to you a little bit. I think maybe I've shared this in the past, but, you know, I mean, there's not a day goes by that I don't get down before God and I say, Lord, if you never answer another prayer of mine, this is the most important prayer that I have for myself personally. Not for other people, but for me personally. I'm dead serious. Take my life rather than ever permit me at a time of weakness, a time of stupidity, a time of foolishness, a time of just being naive or rebellious or defiant, that I end up sinning against you in such a way that it's going to cause your enemies to blaspheme. It's going to cause my weaker brothers and sisters to stumble. It's going to make a mess out of my testimony. It's going to strip me of any moral authority you may have granted me, you know, to teach your word, to preach your word. Because I know Amalek is so powerful. My fallen nature is so powerful. I look at these televangelists, I look at these ministers, I look at these priests, I look at these people in spiritual leadership who have just taken tremendous falls. And whenever these people have taken a tremendous fall, what happens? They give God's enemies an occasion to blaspheme. They cause weaker brothers and sisters to stumble. They make a mess out of everything, and the media just lambastes them. They bring such discredit to God's name because of Amalek. Because of our fallen nature, because of our weakness. And the only way we can really defeat him is through constant, continuous prayer. And I think that that says a lot when you read about how David had to fight him. But look, because he was determined, you know, he believed God, he prayed, he strengthened himself in the Lord, he sought the Lord's advice. What happened? He gained the victory. And look what happened. Look what Amalek is doing just before he's attacked. He says in verse 16, and when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing. You know, that's Amalek. Eating and drinking and dancing. That's Amalek, right? Just indulging the flesh. That's Amalek to a T. That's our flesh to a T. And we really need to take a knife to the flesh. And it can only be, I think we can only gain the victory through prayer. And anyway, it says here in that verse 17, and David slaughtered them until twilight, until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. In verse 18, so David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken and rescued his two wives, but nothing of theirs was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that they had taken for themselves, and David brought it all back. Now here's the thing. If we can defeat Amalek, if we can really defeat our fallen nature, then what happens to us? We become tremendously blessed spiritually. I mean, we really end up having a great deal of spoil, so to speak. Put it this way. To defeat Amalek, it takes a lot of discipline. All right? Now, I can just give you an example. It takes discipline to read God's Word. It takes discipline to pray. It takes discipline to get along with God in prayer. It really does. Right? And it takes discipline, let's say, to fast and pray, this type of thing. You see, what Amalek wants to do, Amalek wants to sit on his fat rear end and watch TV all night. Okay? But a person who's going to be disciplined enough to say, you know what, I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to Bible study, or I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to church, or I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to the prayer meeting, or I'm going to get up and just simply spend time alone with God in prayer. Guess what? You're exercising discipline. You're putting the knife to the flesh. You're doing battle with Amalek. And as a result, you're going to be greatly blessed, and you're going to be, spiritually speaking, you're going to make tremendous progress. But it's always going to be a cost of dying to yourself in order to do it. We always have the choices. Are we going to spend time with God in prayer? Are we going to spend time with God's people? Are we going to spend time reading His Word? Are we going to spend time doing what Amalek wants to do, eating and drinking and dancing and carrying on and being entertained? Because I'm telling you what, the choice is ours, but the end results are different between night and day. And he says here in that verse 20, he says, so David captured all the sheep and the cattle, which the people drove ahead of the other livestock, and they said, this is David's spoil. And when David came to the 200 men who were too exhausted to follow David, who had also been left at the brook Bezor, and they went out to meet David and meet the people who were with him, David approached the people and greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went down with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoils that we have recovered, except to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then David said, you must not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us, who has kept us and delivered into our hands the band that came against us. And who will listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down to the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage, that they shall share alike. And so it has been from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. Now, here's, I think, another instructive thing, is that when David gets back to the brook of Bezor, the 200 men that were left behind to watch the baggage, they come out to meet him, and then a number of the guys in David's outfit says, hey man, these guys didn't go with us to the battle. They're not getting any of the spoil. Tell them to give your wife and kids and get out of here. Well, David looks at the situation and says, hey, no, that's not the way to do it. He says, we're going to share, and we're going to share alike in these spoils. Because look at the guys who were left behind. Now, I don't think that they fell behind because they were cowards. I think that they were just really exhausted because they had been on this trek for 3 days, and then they come down and find out that everything's missing, and then they go out in hot pursuit of Amalek. I mean, they just tuckered out, wore out. And I think it says a lot to us, because in this spiritual battle, not everybody can do the same thing. I mean, we all can't be Billy Graham. We all can't be James Dobson or Chuck Colson or Chuck Swindoll or whoever. You know what I'm saying? We've all been given different talents and different abilities, different strengths, different resources to work with, and not everybody can keep up. But here's the thing. The people that are out there doing the battle or actually engaged in the battle, out there on the front lines, if they are supported by other people, then they will share in the spoils. I mean, just take it where we live and breathe. In regards to, let's say, missionaries, all right? If a missionary is out there in another country, out there witnessing and evangelizing and trying to lead souls for Christ, and then somebody at home is, you know, sending monies to enable this person to do it, well, as far as God's concerned, they're both going to share in the spoils. They're both going to share as far as the rewards. You see, because even though one's not really out there doing the battle, so to speak, they're in a support position, a logistic position that's absolutely crucial. Because what happened here in a situation where the 200 men were left behind? They really became, in a sense, they became an asset to David and his men. How?
They didn't have to worry about what they had left? 200 men were guarding the supplies.
And in guarding supplies, it really freed up David and his men, right? I mean, they didn't have all this luggage to drag with them. You know, they had these guys watching this way. It really freed them up to engage in the enemy. And David, in him, I mean, obviously you see the heart of Christ when it comes to in this spiritual warfare, the battles that we engage in. If people are there supporting you financially, but they're not out there doing the preaching, the teaching, the sermons, and evangelizing, hey, they're still going to receive a part of that spoil. And that was an ordinance that was put into practice, and it was in practice from there on out. And here's the thing, too. It even says here that, in that verse 22, then all the wicked and worthless men among those who went with David answered and said, hey, see what's saying here? Among the 400 men that went into this battle, it says there was worthless and wicked men among them that didn't want to share in the spoils. And if you go back to Proverbs, it says that there's seven things that are an abomination to God. And one of the things is those who stir up strife among brethren. And we told in Hebrews, he says, see to it that no root of bitterness spring up among you, lest thereby many become defiled. And there's all kinds of scriptural admonitions to show that, hey man, when it comes to the body of Christ, when it comes to believers, we really do need to support each other and encourage one another and build each other up and do all that we can to work as a team and to recognize that not everybody can do what we do, or we can't do what everybody else does. We've all been given these different talents. And so, you know, you see this situation where people like these wicked men here says, hey man, that they were just stirring up a lot of strife. And what was their motive? Cut through all the claptrap. It was resentment, it was bitterness, and it was greed. Yeah, and that can really bring a church down. It can bring a fellowship down, this type of thing. Anyway, in concluding this, in verse 26, it says, now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoils to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, behold, a gift for you from the spoils of the enemies of the Lord, to those who are in Bethel, and to those who are in Ramoth of the Negev, and to those who are in Jether, and to those who are in Aor, and to those who are in Siphmoth, and to those who are in Estima, and to those who are in Recall, and to those who are in the cities of the Jeremithites, and to those who are in the cities of the Kenites, and to those who are in Hormah, and to those who are in Borsh Ashan, and to those who are in the Akdesh, and to those who are in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to go. So what it's saying here is that God lists all these different places, or these different towns, these different people that David sends some of these spoils to. And I think that too is significant in this respect. David has now defeated Amalek. So what happens when he defeats Amalek? David becomes a tremendous blessing to a lot of people around him. I mean, spiritually speaking, if we could really discipline our fallen nature to where we become obedient to God, like Jesus said, deny yourself, pick up your cross daily, and follow me. And like Paul says in Romans, that the flesh wars against the spirit against the flesh. In other words, Amalek wars against our spiritual nature, and our spiritual nature wars against Amalek. Well, if we really put Amalek under the sword, if we really deny ourselves and pick up our cross daily and follow Christ, you know what? We become a tremendous blessing, spiritual blessing, to other people through our walk with Christ and through the work that he has for us to do on behalf of other people. Anybody have anything to add or share to that chapter 30? Because this chapter 31, it's only 13 verses. But I think, too, in closing this chapter, you almost, like when you read this chapter 31, you almost have to read the first chapter of 2 Samuel, because the two go hand in hand. But we're not going to get into 2 Samuel tonight.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's everybody has a hot button or buttons, red flag, whatever you want to call it, an area of weakness.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to recognize that, and you got to stay away from that, and yeah, you know, run to the Word and prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. See, here's the thing. We're not going to get rid of this fallen nature, of course, until we die, right? But when we have a resurrected body, we'll be in the presence of God. We will no longer have Amalek to contend with. That's very, very difficult for me to grasp. I mean, I take it on faith, and I believe it with all my heart. But all I've known all my life is this body of sin and death. But here's the thing. When you get to heaven, you're no longer going to have this fallen nature. You're going to be in the presence of God with a new a resurrection body that's no longer going to have this inclination to sin and to do anything that's offensive to God, because it was told very plainly that when we do see Christ, we're going to be like him, and not like him in his divinity, but like him in his moral perfection, and we're not going to be tempted anymore. You know, but that's very difficult for me to grasp, because all I've known experimentally is, you know, 24/7 battle with Amalek. The spirit lusting against the flesh against the spirit. And that's all I've known. And all I can do is just take it on faith and believe that, hey man, there's coming a day when I won't have to drag around this carcass of sin and death anymore, but I'll have a resurrected body that will no longer even be tempted to sin. And that to me would just, to me, be a glorious thing. Because like I said, if you got to heaven and found out that you were still tempted, that you're still struggling with Amalek, then what happens? When Amalek gets the better, what, are you going to end up in hell anyway? See, that's not going to happen. But like I said, I guess in my own childish way of thinking, you know, it's tough for me to grasp it other than intellectually, because experimentally this is all I've known. Anyway, beginning with that first one in chapter 31, when concluding this First Samuel, it says, "Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on the Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abimadad and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, 'Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me.' But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. So Saul took his sword, and he fell on it. And when the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them." Now, before I go any further, this is pretty significant. Is that what happens now is that during this battle on Mount Gilboa, Saul gets hit with an arrow. The archers had hit him. And Saul just figured, man, I'm a dead man. I can't run. I can't flee. I can't fight. And so he tells his armor bearer, "Kill me. Run your sword through me, because I know that I can't escape these Philistines. And as soon as they catch up with me, they're just going to make total sport of me. They're just going to just really, torture me. And so his armor bearer couldn't do it. His armor bearer said, "No, I can't do that. I can't kill you." And so Saul takes his sword, and he falls on his sword to kill himself. Now, here's the thing. It says here in that verse 5, "And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him." Now, if you just put a period there and you don't put this together with 2 Samuel chapter 2, you're not going to get the full picture here. Because what happens is that Saul falls on his sword. He's got an arrow sticking in him. And he probably passes out. His armor bearer thinks that he's dead. So his armor bearer falls on his sword, commits suicide. All right, so that he too won't be made sport of. But here's what happens. Because before we finish this chapter 31, jump over to 2 Samuel. What basically happens in 2 Samuel chapter 1 is that there's an Amalekite. Apparently, he's like a mercenary that was fighting on the side of Saul. And 3 days later, he comes into the camp of David, and his hair is all disheveled, and his clothes are all torn. He's got dust in his hair. And then David questions him, saying, "Well, who are you? Where'd you come from?" And he says, "Well, I came from the battle on Mount Gilboa." And David said, "Well, what happened? What took place there?" And basically, the Amalekite had told him that, "Hey, man, the battle was lost, and Saul is dead, and the people have fled." And then he says in that verse 6, says, "By chance, I happened to come on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, chariots and horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered, 'I am an Amalekite.' Then he said to me, 'Please stand beside me and kill me, for the agony has seized me, because of my life is lingers in me. So I stood beside him and killed him because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, so also did all the men who were with them. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who had told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien and Amalekite." Then David said to him, "How is it that you are not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said, "Go cut him down." So he struck him and he killed him. And David said to him, "Your blood is on your head, and your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Now, the reason I read this whole thing in the 2 Samuel chapter 1 is because it really goes right along with this chapter 31. Because we're told in chapter 31 that Saul was hit by an arrow. He falls on his sword. His armor bearer thinks he's dead. But apparently, Saul revives and he's using his spear to kind of prop himself up when an Amalekite goes rushing by. And I get the impression that the Amalekite was probably just a mercenary, probably employed by Saul to fight in his army. And then Saul calls out to him and he says, "Hey, run me through, kill me before these Philistines get to me." So the guy does it. All right. And then what does David say? You know, the guy was really executing mercy killing, wasn't he? This is a classic example, in my opinion, of mercy killing. All right? Saul's in pain. He's dying. He wants somebody to snuff out his life. But what happens to the guy? He's executed for taking Saul's life. I mean, that to me is very, very profound. And it should say a mouthful to people today who are constantly clamoring for the right to die. Because you may think, well, I'm just assisting a person to take their life. I'm killing them out of mercy. But as far as God is concerned, what are you really doing? You're committing murder. Because we know, you know, if you go back to Psalm 139, what are we told in Psalm 139? We're told that, and I think you get more, I think, of a divine perspective on this, because David said in Psalm 139, he says, "For thou dost form my inward parts, and thou dost weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thee thanks, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are thy works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was made in secret, and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth." Now listen, I'm going to read this. I'm going to see who can give me the correct interpretation of what he's saying. "Thine eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." I'm going to read that again. Okay, and you tell me what he's saying here. "Thine eyes," in other words, God's eyes, "have seen my unformed substance, and in thy book they were all written, the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them."
Before you're born, God has it all planned out. Yeah, he's given us.
That's exactly it. In other words, before we were born, he already saw us. He already knows us. And he's preordained before we even are born. All right? And when he's fashioning us in our mother's womb, he's already determined, "I'm going to give you X number of days." All right? And we can cut those days short by suicide. There's no doubt in my mind about it. All right. Now, we can say, well, people at the end of their life, they're suffering so much, they should be put out of their misery and, you know, just put down like a horse. But I'm just saying, hey, you know what? There's a purpose for that suffering. There's a reason for it. We got to look at things from a divine perspective and not just from our natural mind. We can't let Amalek dictate what should be done, but we should let the Spirit of the Lord dictate what should be done. Because a lot of times if people are at death's door or standing at the threshold of the grave, hey, they may be lingering on there just like Saul was doing. But God in his mercy, why do you think Saul didn't die instantly? What do you think one of the reasons would be that God would allow him to suffer so much just before he died?
Give him time to repent.
Good. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, if Saul had been shot through with an arrow right in his heart and died instantly, you know what? I think that, you know, he wouldn't have had a chance to whisper a prayer. Now, I don't know if the guy repented at the very end there. I would really hope so, because I have a lot of admiration for Saul in spite of all of his tremendous blunders and sins and mistakes. I still see him to be a man who tried hard. You know, he really did. I mean, remember when he went to the witch of Endor? And Samuel told him, hey man, you're going to be dead tomorrow. And Israel is going to be defeated. And your sons are going to die. Well, he made that trek all the way from Endor back to Gilboa, knowing that he's going to his death. When I think a coward probably would have got on his horse and rode off, said, I'm going to leave my army and my sons and everyone to heck with it. I'm going to save my own hiney. Well, he didn't. He went out there and died with his men. And that says a lot to me about the guy. And I just hope that maybe he did repent before the end of his life. And that's what I'm saying. You know, his life lingered on, but I think God had a purpose for that. And I think God has a purpose when people are suffering at the end of their lives, that they still have time to repent. They have time to offer up to God their sufferings, to make atonement for what they've done in the past or whatever. You see? Anyway, back up to that verse 7, because it says here, and when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with those who were beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. Now, look at the difference. Look at the contrast we read in that latter part of that, chapter 30, where David defeats the Amalekites, and he ends up being a tremendous blessing to, you know, all these other people by giving them spoils because of his defeat of Amalek. All right. Well, here's Saul, because of his rebellion, because of his disobedience, you know, he brings judgment upon himself, but upon the rest of Israel. And look at the contrast, that the people who were once living in their houses are now got to flee because the Philistines are now coming in and living in them. You see, a big contrast. When a person really is committed to God and sold out to God and willing to put the knife to the flesh, so to speak, and follow Christ, they become a blessing to others. But here you got leaders that don't do that, and they become a curse to others. Anyway, I didn't want to beat that to death either. But it says here in that verse 8 that it came about the next day that the Philistines came and stripped the slain, and they found Saul and his three sons who had fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head, and they stripped off his weapons, and they sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Now, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there, and they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. Okay, just in concluding this book in this chapter, unfortunately for Saul, the Philistines, when they did get to him, they cut off his head, and they stripped off his weapons, and then what did they do? You know, they put his weapons in the house of their god, the Ashtaroth, and they fashioned his body to this wall of Bethshan. And we learned from Chronicles that it was basically in this square that they put his body up there for as a display, along with his sons, you know, to basically humiliate him, to degrade the body, to just defile his person and his office or his role as king. But interesting thing, it says here in that verse 11, now when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and his bodies. And what did they do? They burned their bones and then they buried them, all right, out of respect, and they fasted 7 days. Anybody remember the first encounter that we have with Jabesh-Gilead as far as Saul was concerned at the very beginning of this book? Interesting thing. It was the men of Jabesh-Gilead were threatened, I think it was by the sons of Ammon, that they were going to gouge out their right eye and become servants to Ammon. And when Saul heard that, he became so incensed, he just cut up his own oxen, and he sent their cut up pieces throughout Israel, and he says, this is what I'm going to do to anybody's oxen who doesn't come to my aid in fighting, you know, Ammon and delivering the men of Jabesh-Gilead. So here it is, years later, these men, I think that they basically remembered how Saul came to their aid, and they in turn march all night, and at a great risk for themselves, they confiscate the body to give it a decent burial. And you know, I think this says a lot about these guys, that they remembered their own deliverance, and as a result, I think that they showed a great deal of character. Because I've said so many times throughout the years, man, I says, you know, one of the things in my opinion that shows a real smallness of character is an ungrateful spirit. No, people who just don't appreciate what others do for them or what God has done for them or what God is doing for them. They just take everything for granted or just become ungrateful pigs. Well, you don't see this with these men of Gabbish Gilead, and I think it's, you know, it should be instructive to us too, that we should always be grateful and always be thankful to those, or especially to God, who's done great things for us. Anybody want to add or share? Because when we do pick up with the 2 Samuel chapter 1, we're going to be going back and forth to this last chapter, because it's hard for me to understand why they made the chapter break there. But the chapter breaks are just done for our convenience. But because the story basically, you know, is interrupted there, we have to go back and forth and read these two together. Anybody want to add or share?